Good evening, everybody. You're in for a treat tonight. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Barbara Goldsmith. I'm a writer, and I've been a trustee here for many, many years. And tonight's event, and all the others that you might be treated to in our fall schedule, are supported by library members and friends like you. And our landmark annual fund helps our collections stay strong and our building be maintained. And we have, which is quite unusual, open hours 7 days a week. So we hope that if you support this library, we're very grateful. And if you don't yet support this library, there's information available at the reference desk on your way out. And also, you can get an event schedule. That said, we got that out of the way. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the eminent author and historian. We plow somewhat the same fields in our writing. And here tonight is David Reynolds. He's the author or editor of 16 award-winning books, including Whitman's America, which won a Columbia University Bancroft Prize, and the English-Speaking Union Ambassador's Book Award, as well as Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and The Battle for America. That was selected as a New Yorker Best Book of the Year. David Reynolds has taught American literature and American studies at several colleges, Northwestern, Barnard, New York University, Rutgers, and the Sorbonne. We are so happy to welcome him tonight and to hear what he has to say. He is now teaching at CUNY's Graduate Center, and his most recent role is as the editor of a definitive selection of the writings of Abraham Lincoln. And this is a time where Lincoln is floating back into our minds, very much so. As one of the foremost experts on the intellectual life of the 19th century, David is wonderfully suited to make this choice and to illuminate Lincoln's writing, history, and also his myth. He's won so many awards in the field of criticism. Reynolds argues that American classic literature is defined by its radical openness to biographical, political, social, and cultural images, which are interwoven in such symbols as Melville's White Whale, or Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, or Poe's Raven, or Whitman's Leaves of Grass. In biography, Reynolds places figures like Whitman and John Brown in their era, the era in which they lived, not in a bell jar, as many writers unfortunately fall. He shows how these figures, their thoughts and motivations, were shaped by the religious, political, and social forces around them. He also brings attention to the numerous long-neglected authors in the field of history, Reynolds highlights the importance of culture, enforcing Lincoln's view that, quote, he who molds public sentiment is greater than he who makes statues. It is my great honor and pleasure to introduce David S. Reynolds.
Thanks very much, Barbara. And we were just talking, Barbara's producing an HBO series or a special on her book, Other Powers, which is a fabulous book, really. That's actually how I met Barbara. Later, she's become my friend. But it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And as you say, we plow the same ground, to be sure. It's about late 19th century spiritualism, and Mary Todd Lincoln was very into spiritualism. Anyway, wonderful book, as are your other books. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming out tonight. It's a good evening to commemorate Lincoln on the 150th anniversary of his death. He died April 14th, 1865. Lincoln, as Barbara mentioned, seems always to be in the news. He's the subject of books, articles, speeches. Pope Francis, in his recent speech before Congress, highlighted four Americans that he says that he thinks shaped fundamental American values. Two were Catholic peace activists, Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton, and a third was Martin Luther King. And the only, and the first name that he mentioned, and the only political figure was Abraham Lincoln. He commended Lincoln for his promotion of liberty. And I agree with this assessment. Who am I to disagree with Pope Francis? But there are different kinds of liberty. And I want to discuss what kind of liberty Lincoln stood for. There will be implications for today, as I think you'll see. And to that end, I'll be discussing an important campaign song, sometimes called the song that got Lincoln elected, called Lincoln and Liberty, which was so popular in 1860 and was sung kind of everywhere. Before I get to that song, though, I want to speak more generally about Lincoln as a man and as a politician. And I want to do so by reading parts of the preface of my current book, Lincoln's Selected Writings. And when I read passages, I'll stop and do a few riffs along the way. And here's how the preface begins. Not with the word Tolstoy, but begins with his quotation. Of all the great national heroes and statesmen of history, Lincoln is the only real giant. This statement by Leo Tolstoy is hard to dispute. Abraham Lincoln, 1809 to 1865, is generally recognized as America's greatest president and its central historical figure. And Lincoln is always at, or at least very, very near, the top of any poll taken of a great American presidents. And it's true of conservative historians, and it's true of liberal historians, which is kind of unusual. Now, there it's true that in some polls, FDR is number one, and he's number two, and so forth, and George Washington is always up there. But in most cases, most polls, he's ranked number one by historians. He embodied many American ideals and qualities. The archetypal self-made man, he was born in a one-room Kentucky log cabin, had a hardscrabble frontier childhood, and rose through various occupations to become an Illinois lawyer, a Whig congressman, and the 16th president of the United States. This was his birth cabin, or reproduction, really, of the cabin, the original cabin. hasn't survived. I was born in the village of Hodgenville, Kentucky, and at eight, the family moved to southern Indiana, another frontier, a section at that time, and then on to Illinois, which was also in Sangamon County, in the area I lived, was also sort of a very, very tiny village that later disappeared called New Salem, and then he lived in Springfield, Illinois, which at the time had, I think, about 4,000 inhabitants. That was considered sort of a big place for him. He moved to Illinois when he was 21, and that was in 1830. And then in 1842, he's married to Mary Todd, who was from a Kentucky slaveholding family. And there's Mary Todd, and they had four children, four sons, two of whom tragically died before Lincoln did, and that was a source of great grief in the family. An autodidact, Lincoln had less than 1 year of formal education. Just to go back, in this frontier area, schools were very scarce. Books were very scarce. Lincoln would walk miles just to get a book, to simply borrow a book. His father was illiterate. His mother was barely literate. But he would just teach himself, basically. I mean, and I think it says a lot about education. As do a lot of other figures of that era, and I'm talking about people like Frederick Douglass, who didn't have even a day of education. But what Frederick Douglass did is that he was enslaved at the time, and he would bribe little white boys. He would steal bread from the kitchen and said, "I'll give you a piece of bread if you teach me a letter, if you teach me a word." And he would use bread to learn letters and words from the white boys who had the advantage of education. And then he was working in a shipyard, and he would try to figure out the words larboard and starboard. He saw them painted, and he would try to figure. And then he very, very slowly built himself up. I'm talking about Frederick Douglass now. And he ended up by being one of the greatest writers of the 19th century, but he escaped from slavery. But he's a real inspiration, Frederick Douglass is. Walt Whitman, the same thing, because Walt Whitman only went to school until age 11. His father was quite poor, and so Whitman had to leave school at age 11. And yet he's second only to Shakespeare in the number of different vocabulary words that he uses in his poetry. And Abe Lincoln, very, very, very similar. He would walk 6 miles to get a book. He would sit there. He would read it. He would think about it. He would read it again and again and again. And his range of reading was not huge the number of books that he read was not huge because there just weren't that many books at that time. Now, later on, he read a lot more. But it makes you think that the most important thing really to instill in students, it seems to me, is a sense of curiosity and just the sheer importance of being able to teach oneself. In other words, it's fine, all the standardized testing is great and everything, but instead of teaching to the test, it seems to me, which unfortunately I think we educators are forced to do too often, if we can also somehow instill a sense of curiosity. So it really becomes largely self-motivated. Because now, even though he didn't read a tremendous number of books, Lincoln did read kind of a variety of books, from the very, very high to the very popular. On the one hand, he knew Shakespeare so well. How many presidents do you know can just stop in the middle of a conversation and recite a Shakespeare soliloquy that goes on for about a page and a half? Not too many, but he could do it, and he didn't do it to impress people either. He just did it because he enjoyed the language, and he just enjoyed it. He wasn't saying, "Oh, I know my I sometimes try to impress people with with the Shweta Sutra, the Jusha Martha Persutra, that's the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. But I only memorized that because my medieval professor, you don't want to hear any more of that, believe me, forced me to do it. Lincoln memorized these things just because he loved it. And during his presidency, he would sometimes recite these things. But he not only liked that, but he memorized the poems of Robert Burns. And he also read one of the most popular humor columns of his day, Petroleum Nasby. The guy's real name was David Ross Locke. But in fact, Lincoln once wrote to Locke and said, I would trade my presidency to be able to write like you. It was kind of amazing. He wrote that after he was reelected even. And he thought that he was reelected in part because of Locke, because Locke, or Nasby, posed as this drunken, no good Democrat. And Copperhead. Back then, the Democrats were the conservatives, and the Republicans were the radicals. He was like sulfuric acid. I mean, the kind of humor is just amazing. It's almost offensive. And yet Lincoln would just read this stuff and endlessly, like before he announced the Emancipation Proclamation, he said, now, Cabinet, I want you to hear. Actually, in that case, it was Artemus Ward, another humorist very similar. But as the election returns were coming in 1864, he read from Nasby. Just before Lee surrendered to Grant in 1865, he read Nasby out loud. And the reason they were a little late to Ford's Theater, horrible evening when he was assassinated, but Mary Todd Lincoln kept saying, you know, we're late. He was entertaining guests with Petroleum Nasby, this corrosive, anti-democratic humor, which is kind of interesting. But the fact that he could enjoy, and not just enjoy, but sort of memorize so many things, and I can't tell you how he was also very, very interested. Well, there was a reason he went to the theater that night. He went to the theater more than 100 times as president, and also he loved popular songs. He loved opera. He actually sort of slept through opera. That's okay, but he especially liked popular songs, and he didn't have any kind of singing voice whatsoever. But his bodyguard, Ward Lehman, had a very good voice, and so he said, you know, Hill, his name is Ward Hill, and Hill would sing me this song, and Hill would sing this song. But what strikes me about Lincoln, even more than, let's say, Douglas or whatever, is that he was interested in kind of every level of culture, from this kind of down-and-out popular culture to the kind of high culture as well. And had a very sincere interest in those things. Religiously, he rejected his Calvinistic Baptist religion and passed through a skeptical free-thinking phase before reaching a pan-religious outlook that took into account both divine providence and human effort, fate, and action. Now, his parents were Baptist, but he never joined a church. In his 20s, he wrote a free-thinking pamphlet that actually attacked religion. And at the time, he was called a deist and a non-believer. But then he became kind of more religious as time passed. He read the Bible. He used passages from it in his speeches. But he never accepted any organized religion. He thought faith was a private matter. He thought that was the whole thing about America, that faith is private, and that people of all religions should be tolerated and accepted. He met with Protestants, Catholics, Jews. He was close to people of all those faiths. And as part of the war effort to inspire the North, he passed 9 proclamations of prayer and fasting during the Civil War, which is more than any other president, except for Jefferson Davis, who did 10. They were trying to get God on their side. Come on, God. And so they were, I guess, both appealing to the same God, but he also put "In God We Trust" on the nation's currency, and he instituted the first national Thanksgiving in 1863. Now, since his death, people of many outlooks, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Quakers, Congregationalists, Catholics, agnostics, and atheists have all laid claim to him. But he really belongs to no category. He would have agreed with Walt Whitman, who said, "Mine is the greatest of faiths and the least of faiths." It was least in that Lincoln accepted no single organized religion, but it was the greatest because he saw the deep value of religious belief, both on the individual and the social level. His last major speech, the second inaugural address, is full of references to God, prayer. It's only 710 words long, but it's full of references to God, to prayer, the Bible. But it does not support a particular religion. In fact, it suggests that no religion contains the final answer about things. He notes in that speech that both the North and the South read the same Bible, prayed to the same God for victory, and the prayers of neither side were completely answered. But in any case, he said in that speech, God's ways remain mysterious and always will be unknown and unknowable to humans. And so he therefore kind of shares the perception of ambiguity and indeterminacy that his great contemporaries Melville and Hawthorne expressed in their fiction. But for Lincoln, ambiguity did not breed confusion or uncertainty. Like two other contemporaries, Emerson and Thoreau, he could put aside organized religion and yet strongly affirm social justice. Just as Emerson and Thoreau went out on a limb to publicly defend the abolitionist warrior John Brown, so Lincoln said that every drop of slave's blood that had been drawn by the lash must be answered by a thrust of the sword. He really was dedicated to that form of social justice for getting rid of slavery. So he didn't kind of wallow in ambiguity. I mean, there was a very, very firm sense of morality there. Folksy and funny, Lincoln was given to storytelling and telling jokes, many of them kind of off color and body. Yet he had a melancholy side that some say yielded periods of depression. I think the depression thing can be perhaps overstated. I think he did have moments of serious depression in the 1830s after the death of Anne Rutledge. And I think around the time of his marriage, there was some kind of back and forth about that. And when Willie dies, their second son who died in 1862, certainly, Mrs. Lincoln was pretty severely depressed at that time, and I think he was too. There are pretty clear signs of that. However, I really don't see kind of a regular pattern of this. That kind of somehow, it's been argued that depression sort of fueled his greatness. I think that kind of a tragic, seeing the tragic side of life, in a way, made him a much deeper, more reflective man, but I don't think it somehow fueled his act of greatness. And he couldn't live without humor. He said, "Without humor, I feel that I would die." And he actually got sometimes into trouble because of his humor, and he was pilloried as the national joker. And there's a pretty good book. I actually wrote a blurb for it. It just came out, called The National Joker. And that's what a number of his critics called him. He was just up there telling jokes. And there's an anti-Lincoln cartoon showing him. He had size 14 feet, and he's doing a dance called the Jim Crow Dance, and he's telling a joke. And his jokes were actually collected in joke books and published in popular joke books during his presidency. So... he excelled in different roles. As a lawyer, he handled some 5,000 cases over 24 years. He never went to law school. Back then, most lawyers didn't go to law school. He read a few law books, did a little apprentice work for an Illinois lawyer, became a partner in one firm, and then he started his own firm with a partner, and he went on for 24 years. He had an unusual view of the law. Back then, the words lawyer and liar were considered almost synonymous. And gosh forbid, it was said that many lawyers were in it just for the money. Money. But Lincoln really had a reputation, a different kind of reputation. He said that lawyers must keep their fees reasonable. They should avoid litigation at all costs, unless it was morally justified. And he wrote, "Never stir up litigation. A worse man can scarcely be found than one who does this. As a peacemaker, the lawyer has a superior opportunity of being a good man." Okay, being a good man. And then he went on, "A moral tone ought to be infused into the profession, which should drive such bad men out of it." And actually, this was the main reason why he earned his nickname, Honest Abe. Now, he represented major corporations quite often, so it wasn't that, but he really wanted to take cases that he believed in, cases that he actually believed in. I don't think he would have made a very good public defender. But at any rate, as a politician, he skillfully built the Whig Party in Illinois, and he also helped. As you know, the Whig Party fell apart in the 1850s and replaced by the Republican Party, and that was the anti-slavery party, and the Democrats were the conservative party back then, and he kind of led the rise of the Republican Party in the 1850s. And he was a canny politician. In many ways, he was, I suppose, the opposite of Donald Trump. Lincoln was all about humility. He brought attention to his own humble background, his physical awkwardness and homeliness. He always would say, "I'm so ugly," and everything. His modest lifestyle, he kind of, in a way, overdid that. Maybe playing the Ben Franklin, poor Richard card or something like that. When he criticized his opponents like Stephen Douglas, he did so with very subtle wordplay and with rapier-like logic, and also with very firm appeals to morality. He had kind of a very eloquent but also a rather moderate style. As president, he developed a firm-handed style that involved making highly difficult but ultimately effective decisions that led to the emancipation of 4 million enslaved people. And his firm-handed style began at the very beginning of the Civil War, when the Confederates bombed Fort Sumter. And some members of Lincoln's administration said, "Oh, just give up the forts and let them go to the South." But Lincoln said, "No, absolutely not. These are federal property. We're not going to give them up. I'm sorry." And he sent supply ships to Fort Sumter, and that triggered the Civil War. Soon he was calling up troops and engaging in full-fledged war. And he was so firm as president that he issued several unpopular proclamations. His most controversial one was the one suspending habeas corpus, which many saw as a violation of civil liberties, but which he said was allowed by the Constitution in times of rebellion or invasion. He also cracked down on disloyal newspapers. The topic of Harold Holzer's excellent new book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press, which some said violated freedom of the press. He took these actions to quell the rebellion, to restore the Union, but of course he was labeled a wicked tyrant by Northern Democrats, known as Copperheads, and by, of course, the Confederates in the South. And here's an anti-Lincoln. He was known as an ape, Lincoln the Ape. And so there was a cartoon showing him stomping on habeas corpus and freedom of the press, and with a crown on his head, like a tyrant. And someone who thought he was a tyrant wrote in his diary, "I hate this king, this wicked king." He thought after Lincoln was reelected in 1864, Booth kept writing about our tyrant, Abe Lincoln. Booth was a Southern sympathizer, and so he was really driven by this anti-tyrant kind of thing to kill Abraham Lincoln. As commander-in-chief, Lincoln helped guide battlefield strategy and made a succession of military appointments that ended with the brutal, victorious hammer-and-anvil campaign of Sherman and Grant. So now, at the beginning, Lincoln stumbled. We all know that. McClellan, he could inspire the troops, but he didn't really want to move there in Virginia very much. He was quite timid on the battlefield. Burnside, there were a bunch of lemons as generals, shall we say. But what was good is that Lincoln read a lot of books on battlefield strategy. Once again, reading. He kept reading books. He kept going to the telegraph office, spent a lot of time there, and actually learned a lot of the code, the Morse code, so he could almost hear what was being said from the battlefield. And he really was very, very hands-on. And when he finally found Grant and McClellan, he gave them looser rein, and the result, we all know the result. He made the wise decision. When the war began, it was always on to Richmond, let's conquer Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy. But then Lincoln got it figured out. Let's kill their army. Let's get rid of their armies. Let's destroy their infrastructure as much as we can, their supply, where their supplies were coming, and that's why Sherman created his swath of destruction through Georgia and the Carolinas, and this really crippled the Confederacy. So in the end, some people call it total war. I think total is really a little too strong. I would accept Sherman's phrase, which is hard war. It was definitely hard war. Lincoln combined a hatred of slavery with a deep commitment to the Union, to the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. His anti-slavery reading of the Declaration of Independence had shaped abolitionism before him, but he was the first one to bring it to national prominence in his 1858 debates with Senator Stephen Douglas, known as the Little Giant. He was only 5'4", and Lincoln was 6'4", so it was... And then Lincoln was the first to capitalize on this idea fully in politics with his successful runs for the presidency in 1860 and 1864. His initial public pronouncements on slavery were not nearly as radical as those of abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison or Wendell Phillips, whom Lincoln actually opposed because of their dismissal of the Constitution, which they regarded as a pro-slavery document, and their demand for the separation of the North from the South. They were saying, okay, South, you go your own way, and we Northerners will be here without slavery. You can have your slavery. And Lincoln didn't want that. And he won votes by affirming the Union, but delivering an anti-slavery message in eloquent and often humorous ways that were appealing to mainstream voters. And at all costs, he avoided inflammatory language. He really tried to walk a tightrope of moderation in the tone of his language, even though it was very, very forceful. But at the same time, it wasn't like William Lloyd Garrison, who said, "I will be heard." Garrison was kind of, "I will be heard." And Garrison would burn the Constitution in public. Lincoln was not like that. Lincoln's nickname, the Great Emancipator, is sometimes questioned by those who take note of a conservative streak in him. Early in his career, it's true, he accepted the racial views that were prevalent in his era. He once said there's a physical difference between whites and blacks that might prevent the races from living on equal terms in America, which helps explain his early on support of so-called colonization, which was the plan to deport blacks to Liberia or Central America or elsewhere. Critics of Lincoln to this day focus on such views and on the fact that the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed enslaved people living in states disloyal to the Union, was a partial gesture because it didn't free the slaves everywhere. and did not free the slaves in states that were loyal to the Union. But we must recognize that the Emancipation Proclamation was an enormously important document, greeted with wild celebration among many Americans and with bitter hostility by others. And it does seem odd that the Emancipation did not free all the slaves, but that's because there were four slave states, they're in yellow here, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and Kentucky, that were only tenuously attached to the Union. And although these border states in the end did not join the Confederacy, there was always the possibility that one or more of them might do so, and Lincoln wanted to avoid anything that might push them over the edge into secession. He said, if we lose Kentucky, we lose everything. He said that more than once. If we lose Kentucky, we're just going to lose it all. So that's why that kind of if is there in the Emancipation, or that kind of hedge is there in the Emancipation Proclamation. So it's utterly mistaken to see Lincoln as a white supremacist and a reluctant emancipator who was, quote, forced into glory, which is the title of one book on Lincoln, it's an anti-Lincoln book. There's no reason to doubt his declarations such as, I have always hated slavery, I think as much as any abolitionist, or I hate it because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself, I hate it because it deprives a Republican example of its just influences in the world, and his respect for African Americans grew measurably during the Civil War as he witnessed the courage of black Union soldiers and became close to black leaders like Frederick Douglass, who said, in all my interviews with Mr. Lincoln, I was impressed with his entire freedom from the prejudice against the colored race that I see in many other white people. And when the feminist abolitionist Sojourner Truth visited him in the White House, she was impressed by his kindness, not only to her, but to the many other African Americans that he was greeting in the White House that day. She said, I'm proud to say I was never treated by anyone with more kindness and cordiality and respect than was shown to me by the great and good man Abraham Lincoln. So on a personal basis, he was free of prejudice. Particularly, I think, as time went on, the more that he was kind of meeting African-American leaders. He also abandoned the idea of deporting blacks and completely dropped that plan and tried and revised his position from simply trying to stop the spread of slavery into the West by advocating its complete extinction by force and by constitutional amendment. Toward the end of the war, he proposed that the vote should be granted to blacks who were, in his phrase, quote, very intelligent or who had served in the Union Army. That sounds a little restrictive, but it was one baby step toward the 15th Amendment, which came along in 1870, years later, and gave the vote to African Americans. So he didn't quite get the whole way there, but he was the first president who publicly advocated the vote for African Americans. And now, how many have actually seen the movie Lincoln by Spielberg? If you haven't seen it, you might want to rent it on demand or something. It's a very powerful movie. Yes, there are inaccuracies, to be sure, as there are in any historical movie. But I think, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis really, really nails Lincoln. It's my wife complained it's kind of a talky movie, which it is. It's kind of talky. But Lincoln was kind of talky, all right? You know, he was sort of, you know, talk, you know, tell us stories and everything like that and sort of digress. And there was a lot of debate. The whole movie's about the 13th Amendment. And it shows what Lincoln was trying to do and using his muscle, his presidential muscle, in whatever way he could to get that through his patronage and this and that and the other, and trying to navigate in the background and using his... And it only passed by 7 votes in the House, so it was relatively close. I mean, kind of could have gone either way. It had already failed earlier when it had come up earlier. So, that's why I like that movie. It's a very important political moment, and I think it really shows a lot about Lincoln. His basic quest was to hasten slavery's destruction without violating the Constitution or destroying the existing political system, as disunionists on both sides of the slavery divide felt impelled to do. He wanted to end slavery but preserve the United States, which he considered the world's greatest hope for democracy. His choice was to aim toward emancipation while keeping within the nation's established governmental structures and respecting the Union and the electoral process, which he defended in the firmest military manner. And here he differs really from abolitionists like Garrison and John Brown. John Brown invaded the South before the Civil War in an effort to free the slaves by triggering a huge slave rebellion. He was captured, he was hanged. He became a heroic martyr. I wrote a book on John Brown, and I showed that he really became a true inspiration for Northerners. But Abe Lincoln very much sympathized with John Brown, but said his means were unlawful. This is not the way you can do things in America. You can't just pick up your guns and go south and try to trigger a slave rebellion. And Garrison, as I mentioned earlier, wanted to divide the North and the South. So Lincoln really, really wanted to do it the right way, to do it through the electoral process, and not like these radicals. And it was very, very hard to do this because slavery was so deeply entrenched in America. Now, the founders did not use the word slavery in the Constitution, but as a nod to the South, they included the clauses about three-fifths representation and returning fugitives from labor to their masters. And this is why many Americans of Lincoln's day assumed that the Constitution was a pro-slavery document. And Southerners thought so. They went to war in the belief that they were defending the Constitution. On the other side, the abolitionists thought so too, which is why Garrison calls the Constitution a covenant with death, an agreement with hell, and why he burns it in public. Slavery seemed to be a permanent fixture. 12 American presidents had owned slaves. The presidency was in slaveholders' hands for 50 of its first 64 years. And then a slave owner, John Marshall, was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from 1801 to 1835 and was succeeded by Roger Taney, who held office until 1864, all of them slaveholders. Speakers of the House were almost always slaveholders, as were presidents pro tem of the Senate. So Lincoln faced an enormous challenge when he tried to combat slavery through the electoral process. He fought the battle not only militarily, but with his eloquence. His main weapons were logic and rhetoric. Some of his speeches, as in the debates with Stephen Douglas or the address at Cooper Union here in New York, were notable for their lawyerly logic and historical acuity. His argument was that the founders had put slavery on the path to extinction. Yes, Jefferson was a slaveholder, Washington was a slaveholder, a lot of them were slaves, but there was an anti-slavery impulse there that was shown, for example, in their banning of the slave trade as of 1808 and their passage of the Northwest Ordinance, which banned slavery from expanding into the Northwest Territory. So he said the slavery instinct was there. They couldn't abolish slavery at that moment, but it was there. And everything since then, recently, has been against their point of view, such as the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Compromise of 1850, the Dred Scott decision. And he also quoted statements by people like Jefferson. "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." And he was talking about slavery there. So even Jefferson as a slaveholder, we can call him a hypocrite, but there was an instinct for, and Washington when he died, manumitted his slaves. So Lincoln really, really capitalizes on that. But he did more than just bring attention to anti-slavery ideals within the founder's vision. He positively reshaped these ideals through his rhetoric. Several of his speeches contain images like "the house divided against itself cannot stand," "the better angels of our nature," "the mystic chords of memory," "a new birth of freedom," "malice toward none," phrases that have timelessness and immortality and universality. His two finest speeches, the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural, were pithy and inspirational. Some of you recall that old Bee Gees song, "It's Only Words and Words Are All I Have to Steal Your Heart Away." This is going from the sublime to the ridiculous, I know, to quote the Bee Gees. But anyway, in effect, Lincoln does this in his greatest speeches. He steals our hearts with his words. And he knew the power of well-crafted language. And I'd just like to read the Gettysburg Address, which is only 266 words. It was unusual on that day in November 1863 because the previous speaker that day, Edward Everett, gave a windy oration that lasted 2 hours. It was filled with details and flowery rhetoric and everything. It wasn't a terrible speech, but on and on and on. And he also did that from memory. And Lincoln, with his 260, actually had a paper. Oh, well, there's the paper in his hand there. These are not photographs. But anyway, he was going from notes. he had written it kind of over a period of time, but kind of finalized it down there in Pennsylvania, finalized it the evening before. 47 years ago, our fathers, Daniel Day-Lewis does a good job, I think, of imitating his voice, which I really can't do. His voice was rather high-pitched tenor voice. Mine's, I guess, more of a baritone or something, I don't know, but anyway. But it was a voice that carried very, very well. It carried wonderfully. I mean, thousands of people could hear him. He also had an Indiana accent, and I don't even know how to do an Indiana accent. But 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. Gettysburg, of course, is in Pennsylvania, where Robert E. Lee, the previous July, had brought his troops. And if he had won at Gettysburg and had come into the North, I mean, that was really bad news. But he was stymied, pushed back. He wasn't chased enough. He could have been maybe destroyed, but still he was pushed back. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those here who gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus so far nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God, he actually added that at the last minute, under God, that wasn't in the original, but he added it impromptu at that moment, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. And there are many things to say about the speech, but I want to bring attention to what was known as the higher law. Now, many anti-slavery people of his time, judging the Constitution to be pro-slavery, had long said there was a higher law than the Constitution, the law of justice and morality by which slavery was evil. But people who used the phrase got into big trouble. They were accused of violating the Constitution, and they were called dangerous radicals. So Lincoln avoids that phrase, but in the Gettysburg Address, by a rhetorical sleight of hand, he brings the higher law into the heart of the American experiment by appealing to the nation's founding document, the Declaration of Independence. He tells that actually a higher law defined America from the very beginning, 1776. That higher law was the notion that the nation was conceived in liberty and was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Lincoln goes on in the rest of the speech to indicate that this war is being fought over this very principle. And that's why he says so many Americans have died in battle. You know that 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War, more than in all of the wars combined. So it was, you know, a real sacrifice. He says that no matter what the Constitution says about slavery, the Declaration of Independence truly defines America with its assertion about human equality. And he knew that if he used the phrase the higher law, or if he stated ideas stridently, he could have turned off his listeners, and as it was, some opponents took him to task in the newspapers. They called the Gettysburg Address an assault on the Constitution. That's true. But this was a minority opinion in his day and ours, and the address is regarded as perhaps the greatest American speech. What makes it great is that it delivers a radical notion, all humans are created equal, in language that doesn't really seem radical at all. Instead, the language is measured, it's balanced, it's surprisingly humble. I said earlier the part of Lincoln's charm was his humility, and it comes through here too. A lot of the speech is delivered in modest negatives. We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here. And the soldier sacrifices are above our poor power to add or detract. So a lot of it is kind of phrased in this sort of Lincolnian modesty and humility. Just as these negatives strip away any sense of radicalism, so the positive words in the speech, conceived in liberty, consecrated, a new birth of freedom, and then the added under God, have connotations of organic union through images of conception and birth and religion with references to the divine. So before our eyes, Lincoln creates a rhetorical masterpiece that literally redefines the nation without seeming at all shocking or revolutionary. And I want to say a few more words about, obviously, the Gettysburg Address is in Lincoln's selected writings. This is my new book, but I have hundreds of other writings too, and I just want to say a few words about my latest book, which just came out in January. There have been over 16,000 books on Lincoln, more than any other figure, apparently, than Jesus Christ. And what my book does is, for the first time, it brings together a selection of works by Lincoln, and then a second section has works about him in the 19th century, songs, poems, essays, humorous columns, anti-Lincoln, pro-Lincoln things, and then a selection at the end of modern historians and commentators looking back on Lincoln. People like Harold Holzer, Jim McPherson, Eric Foner, on and on and on. And so I bring those three bodies of writings together. And one section of my book is dedicated to the relationship between Lincoln and Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman, as you know, Whitman was born on Long Island and raised there, and then he lived most of his life in Brooklyn, but he spent a lot of his time in Manhattan. He saw the need for a frontier president so clearly that he fantasized about a Lincoln-like leader years before Lincoln came on the national scene. In the 1850s, before Lincoln came there, Whitman was appalled by the incompetency of American presidents like Pierce, like Buchanan, like Fillmore. At a time when the nation was unraveling over slavery, in his 1855 volume, Leaves of Grass, he tried to rescue his nation through poetry. He says, the poets will be the presidents of these people, because the presidents have failed us totally. He really thought as a poet he could heal America. But far from changing America, his book was virtually ignored. 1,000 copies were published in the first printing. He thought it would go through many, many printings, but he literally had to give away a lot of copies of Leaves of Grass. Nowadays, each, you know, they'd be worth, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand dollars if you could get a first edition of them. But anyway, although Whitman never gave up writing poetry, he saw that what was really needed was a new kind of president. And so he wrote in 1856, remember this was long before Lincoln rose to truly national importance, "I would be much pleased to see some heroic, shrewd, fully formed, healthy-bodied, middle-aged, beard-faced American blacksmith or boatman come down from the West across the Alleghenies and walk into the presidency." You know, it's almost like a job description. 5 years later, such a president arrived. Whitman could almost not believe what had happened. The White House was now occupied by a man who, in Whitman's word, had, quote, "been raised in the commonest average of life, a rail splitter and a flat boatman, one who was quite thoroughly Western, original, and nonconventional." Now, Whitman was in Brooklyn then, but he, in 1862, went down to look for his brother George, who was wounded at Fredericksburg, and he spent time in Washington, several years in the hospitals and so, and he saw Lincoln at one point almost every day in the streets. Lincoln went around in his carriage with Mary Todd Lincoln, and also they would often take rides out to the soldiers' home, which was like the Camp David of the day. It was 3 miles out of town. And once Whitman and Lincoln sort of bowed to each other. Whitman declared that Lincoln, despite some flaws, was, quote, "the greatest, best, most characteristic, artistic, moral personality that America produced." The shock of Lincoln's assassination on April 14, 1865, in Ford's Theater was most memorably registered in Whitman's famous poem, "O Captain, My Captain." And I just want to read the first and last verse of that poem. This is the longhand version that Whitman wrote out. "Oh, Captain, you have to realize that this was just a month after the North had won. The North had won the war. There, you know, Lee had surrendered on April 9th, and not a month. It was just 5 days. So everyone was just exultant and cheering. And Walt Whitman was in Brooklyn. When Whitman heard the news, he was absolutely, totally silent. And his whole family, he was there with his mother, they didn't say one word all day, not even one word. And they just were going around like totally shell-shocked. "Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting, while follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring, but heart, oh, the bleeding drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen, cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips," this is the last verse, "his lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse or will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I with mournful tread walk the deck. My captain lies fallen, cold and dead. And this poem has a sharp poignancy and sadness, showing just how the nation felt in those days, just after Lee had surrendered, and there was incredible celebration throughout Washington, throughout the nation. And then he was killed in the theater while watching a silly farce by the name of Our American Cousin. But it, as I say, he liked these kind of farcical things. So I think he actually died happy, because the last words he heard was, "You old sockdologizing man trap," and that was just slang for it's what the American actor says about this snobby British woman who's trying to get him because he's rich for her daughter. And it was at that point that Booth knew that, because Booth was a famous actor. He was almost like the Robert Redford. I'm really dating myself, the Robert Redford of his day. You know, he was a very handsome actor and so forth, very, very famous. So he knew the play by heart, and he knew that line would create a tumult, and everyone would be distracted by that line. And so he went in there, shot him. Anyway, another poem that Whitman wrote, he wrote four poems. I'm only going to sample one more. "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed" had a very different message. It communicated Whitman's belief that through the tragedy of Lincoln's death, Americans were more strongly cemented than before. They were more unified in their devotion to his memory than they otherwise would be. And he actually said, "Lincoln's death, as horrible as it was, is the greatest cement of the American Union." And it's not that Lincoln didn't have people who despised him, because he did, even after his death, of course. If you read Martha Hodes's recent book, there were a lot of Southerners who said, "Oh, you know, it's just great that he was shot. It's great that he was killed. It's wonderful." So I'm not saying that. And there's a tradition of loathing Lincoln. There's a book called Loathing Lincoln. So up to this day, there are people who loathe Lincoln. But I'm saying, in general, I think Whitman was right to say that it had a unifying effect, because it made a martyr out of him. Now, in this poem of Lilacs, Lincoln becomes the Western Star, always present in the American heaven like a shining beacon. There, in all seasons, including the ever-returning spring with its lilacs, a symbol of the new birth of freedom that Lincoln had talked about at Gettysburg. And I'd like to read the opening two verses. "When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring." And this was true, because Walt Whitman, for the rest of his life, when springtime came, would give his lecture, "The Death of Abraham Lincoln." He began that particularly in Camden, and he actually made a fair amount of money from giving that over and over again every spring. "Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and the thought of him I love." And some of this was based on fact, because Whitman had been there on March 4th, 1865, the day of Lincoln's second inauguration, and a freak of nature occurred. It had been raining all morning, but when Lincoln spoke at 1 p.m. outside the Capitol, the sun broke through, and as the carriage was taking the Lincolns and their cortege back to the White House, a seeming miracle happened. Venus appeared in the western sky because of the extreme clarity of the air at that moment and the kind of positioning in the sky. And thousands of people present, including Lincoln, pointed up at Venus, which in turn becomes Whitman's symbol for Lincoln himself, the star that is always there in the American heavens. Another unusual thing that particular spring was the early lilacs. So that's another kind of image here. Now, Lincoln was beloved not only among writers like Walt Whitman, but also among the common people. He was really the people's president. Several days a week, he held an open house for average Americans who wanted to come and meet him. For hours, people would stream in and out of the White House, shake his hand, and talk with him. So much so that his private secretary, John Hay, got annoyed and had to slow down the flow. But Lincoln kept up the custom, except in times of stress, as when his son Willie died in 1862. And at that time, he kind of closed himself in Willie's room. And Mary Todd Lincoln, she was sort of a basket case at that moment. But anyway, but other than that, he was very, very open. On the day of his second inauguration in 1865, he and Mrs. Lincoln held a huge reception at the White House in which they personally greeted between 5,000 and 6,000 people. So if you can imagine shaking hands with 5,000 to 6,000 people after you've given the second inaugural address and everything. And common people developed a real affection, devotion to Lincoln, whom they called either Old Abe or Honest Abe or Father Abraham. This devotion motivated volunteers to join the Union Army, as indicated by a marching song that I reprint in my book called We Are Coming, Father Abraham. The song went through many versions using different numbers according to how many troops Lincoln was calling up at a particular time. Once it was 300,000, once it was 500,000, once it was 600,000. So I'll use all three numbers here when I demonstrate the song. I'm just going to do the first couple of verses. We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more, from Mississippi winding stream and from New England shore. We leave our plows and workshops, our wives and children dear, with hearts too full for utterance, but with a silent tear. We dare not look behind us, but steadfastly before. We are coming, Father Abraham, 500,000 more. We are coming, we are coming, our union to restore. We are coming, Father Abraham, 600,000 more. So, and if you can imagine, it was a very, very long, so if you can imagine thousands of soldiers singing that at once. When one guy sings, it sounds a little ridiculous. I realize that, but you have to imagine it, you know? And it's kind of hard to read all the words, but it's a very long song, but people would memorize and just sing it about Father Abraham. And to return to my opening remarks about what Pope Francis mentioned, Lincoln and liberty, there's a debate over Lincoln's heritage with regard to the notion of liberty. For some, liberty, Lincoln meant free labor and free market with little regulation or interference. For others, Lincoln meant liberty in the sense of equal rights for all, often combined with strong governmental action. Both points of view have validity, but in this case, the latter view is the most accurate. From his earliest political years back in Illinois, Lincoln was a big believer in activist government that did what it could to bring about change. When he was a state politician, change meant government investment in roads and canals and so forth, what they called internal improvements, but what we would call infrastructure. This dedication to investing in infrastructure continued under Lincoln when he was president. Lincoln strengthened the central government in other ways too. He passed the first federal income tax. He created a national bank and a national currency. He tried to implement the plan of compensated emancipation or pay off slave owners, which would have been a tremendous burden for the government to pay slave owners to free the slaves. He made federal lands available to settlers under the Homestead Act. And of course, he invested massive federal funds into the war that ended slavery. And in the last month of his life, he signed into law the Freedmen Bureau Bill, which made available education, housing, and job opportunities for emancipated blacks in what was the federal government's boldest foray yet into social welfare, what we would call social welfare. Now, before Lincoln took office, the government had little presence for Americans except the post office. Before the war, liberty was negative liberty, a liberty from, a hands-off liberty, a let-me-alone kind of liberty. But in Lincoln's hands, liberty changed. It became a positive liberty, a liberty for, reflected in the post-war amendments with our language like, Congress shall have the power to enforce, and so forth, that kind of language. This was liberty in the interest of social justice and the betterment of people of all classes and colors. And it was this kind of liberty that helped Lincoln get elected In the first place, the most popular campaign song of the 1860 election, sung at rallies throughout the North, was Lincoln and Liberty. Written and performed by the Hutchinson Family Singers, who, as I mentioned, were like the Beatles of their day. Again, I'm kind of dating myself. I should say the One Direction, is it? Anyway. They were immensely popular. They were also like the hippies of their era. Notice their long hair. No, everybody had long hair back then. But they were radical. They really were radicals who supported abolitionism and women's rights and all kinds of progressive reforms. But if you think of the cultural impact of a song like Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, you have a sense of the kind of effect of their song Lincoln and Liberty, because it pushed Lincoln even farther in an anti-slavery direction than he probably publicly wanted to be, particularly in different versions of it. This was the official version, but there were a lot of versions. You can see them on YouTube, which are really, really radical. I mean, they're really radically abolitionist. So this is like the sanitized version. And a couple of the words about the song. It mentions all three states associated with Lincoln: Kentucky, where he was born; Indiana, which is here called Hoosierdom, where he was raised; and Illinois, referred to in the word suckers, because that was the nickname. If you were from Illinois, you were called a sucker. I think it was because of a fish, a sucker fish, I believe. Another note, in the second verse, the slavocrats' giant is the so-called little giant Stephen Douglas, the famous opponent in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. So when the verse says, our good David's sling is unerring, the slavocrats' giant he slew. The image is of Lincoln as the David who slew the Goliath, or the great Douglas. Ironically, of course, Douglas was so little physically, but anyway. And in the last verse, the felling and mauling is about Lincoln as a muscular woodchopper who fells trees and uses a maul or a sledgehammer. He was really physically powerful. He was on his deathbed. People were amazed just how he was very sinewy and very sort of thin, but very muscular and very strong. He could, even during his presidency, he could hold a very heavy axe straight out, extremely heavy axes, just straight out like that. He had real power, and this the last verse kind of communicates that. So, hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through, the pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too. Our good David's sling is unerring, the slavocrat's giant he slew. Then shout for the freedom preferring, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through, the pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too. They'll find what by felling and mauling our railmaker statesmen can do. For people are everywhere calling for Lincoln and liberty too. Then up with our banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. We'll fight till our flag is victorious for Lincoln and liberty too. Thank you. I think we have a little time, do we, Sarah, for a few questions or comments? Pardon my voice. You know, I mean, these kinds of songs were really meant to be sung at rallies with a lot of people singing, and, you know, not by one person, but yeah. Well, there are Abraham Lincoln societies, and where I got this especially was when I'm doing research on a new book on Lincoln. I'm doing sort of a cultural biography of writing that for Penguin right now. And I went out to Springfield, Illinois, where he lived for many years, and I happened to get there on the 150th anniversary of his funeral, which ends up there in Springfield. And so kind of everywhere you went in Springfield, there was a Lincoln impersonator, almost like going to Memphis or something. Elvis is everywhere or something like that. You know, there's Abe, you know, hi, Abe. So, and not only that, but everywhere you look in Springfield, at least when I was there, almost every corner they had pictures of Lincoln. And to me, it was really, really neat. I was kind of in my element. I sort of enjoyed it. And a lot of tourists were kind of flocking there. It's kind of interesting. Does anybody know? Richard, maybe you know. I know there are Lincoln societies, but I think in general we've kind of steamrolled these, as you say, these two presidents kind of into one. And we kind of homogenized it. And so in terms of public celebration, it's kind of like Lincoln homogenized Thanksgiving. He wanted to create a national sense of Thanksgiving. So before that, it had always been Forefathers' Day, which is celebrated December 22nd, which was all about celebrating the Puritans in New England. But then after that, Forefathers' Day kind of disappeared because Lincoln wanted to get rid of New England just itself as an object of celebration. He wanted to make it a national Thanksgiving, which is why he declared a national Thanksgiving in 1863. So in a way, he did that kind of homogenization himself. In a Lincoln bookstore, yeah, in bookstore. And if you go, the one thing I wish I brought today was my Abe Lincoln hat, which I bought in Springfield, and I was going to wear that today, but I left it at home. I don't really look like Abe, but I'm about his height maybe, but not. I wish I had his. Thin body, but anyway. But yeah, it's worth going to see. Now, Springfield itself, you know, it's not the most exciting city in the world, but it's really interesting to go there. They have a wonderful museum. They have a great library where I did some really great research. So it's, and I went to Fort Wayne where they have another Lincoln Museum, which is really great too. So, because he lived in Indiana for a while. But any other questions? Yeah.
Did Emerson and the Transcendentalists support him?
Yeah, Emerson was a tremendous Lincoln fan, and he wrote a wonderful. Included in my book is are some moving pieces by Emerson about Lincoln. He gave a wonderful eulogy. He wrote about the Emancipation Proclamation. He's the one who said the Gettysburg Address is just, you know, he says, like, there are three good speeches: the Gettysburg Address, John Brown's appeal to the Virginia court, and then some European speech. There are three very, very good speeches, and Gettysburg Address is number one. Yeah.
If Lincoln were alive today, what would he say about Congress?
Wow. Yeah. It's tough to think of transplanting him. I think what he had was a certain ability to really charm people. Now, all of his jokes and stories and wit, maybe they aren't of today's taste necessarily, but if he were alive today, I think that he would know how to adapt his humor and his kind of charm and wit. He had newspaper editors who hated him, and he would have them in his office, kind of sit them down, talk to them, and somehow he had this ability to kind of what we would call reach across the aisle. Although even then, he did face a lot of opposition in the North. And in the 1860 election, he got less than the popular vote than his three combined opponents, but he won the Electoral College. And George McClellan, his opponent in 1864, who was a Copperhead, actually did pretty well. Now, in the end, because of the fall of Atlanta and because of the Union victories, Lincoln won. If Atlanta hadn't fallen, everything, who knows what would have happened. There was a lot of anti-Lincoln stuff going on there, so he faced a very difficult moment. Any other Yes. It was basically to raise money for the war effort. The union wasn't doing well financially, and just as he had to impose the draft, and also just as he had to sort of create this new national currency of greenbacks, so he supported the federal income tax. I'm not sure what he modeled it after, but yeah. So, anyway, thank you very much. Thank you for coming.